Vancouver Island, a land full of rich, diverse cultures where you will find hippies and rednecks at the same local brew pub, blue-collar and white-collar camping side-by-side at the lakes, and old and young and everyone in between with one thing in common, we love our island. The storytellers of Vancouver Island are many. From time out of mind, its people have told stories for generations, the imprints its shores, peaks, and valleys have had on each one. Today, we're joined by Caleb Harding, Tofino resident and lover of all things on the West Coast, and we're going to hear his stories, his experiences, and his incredible impact on the wilderness side of Vancouver Island. So earlier this spring and winter, I was putting together a campaign for season two, and I had put out, you know, the call for people to have on the show. Out of all the people that had come back to me with suggestions, your name, Caleb, was one of the highest, most sought after individuals on Vancouver Island. So, I mean, we spared no expense, flew you over to the other side of the island, and here you are in the studio, Mr. Caleb Harding. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Super fun.
We're still waiting for my voucher for lunch, but
it'll come eventually. You know, give me some time. They were a little slow in the kitchen today. You know, we'll get there. No, super stoked to have you on the show, fellow Islander, and just really loved watching your journey. Others have as well, and I think that there's something to the conversation, especially inside of the wilderness, that you have really made a mark. And you've really started to show people that, you know, you have value for it, but also you want to bring other people into it. And I'm all about finding people like that, and especially on the beautiful West Coast where you find home. So, tell us whereabouts you're from currently right now.
Yeah, just like, yeah, to say thanks again. And I'm really glad that we were able to make this work. You know, it's always funny when we find people that are just as invested in the outdoors. It can be really difficult to meet up because we have such packed schedules.
Totally. Every weekend's like, I'm going here, here, and here. I don't know if I can go there.
Yeah, maybe I can meet you for 15 minutes at this rest stop.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now with, the better weather.
Yeah. It's so much nicer.
There's a lot to do. It's been a long winter.
Yes.
But yeah, we are coming from Tofino on the west coast of Vancouver Island. It's somewhere that I have spent quite a bit of time and I've spent more time thinking about it over the course of my life than anywhere else. And I live there with my wife, Bethany, and our son, who's 9 months old, Elliot.
Welcome to fatherhood.
Thank you.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's been a wild ride.
Oh, man. It's such a steep learning curve. Mm-hmm. How's that going?
It's going well. It's been a really great adjustment. I've always sort of identified as a father, even before having Elliot. It just seems like it was my end goal and what I've always wanted to do. Mm. So now that we have, a son, it's been really great to kind of fall into that role. And we're in a place where we're really well supported by family and friends. And it's been really interesting, but really exciting to integrate him into our lifestyle.
Totally. So for Tofino, is that somewhere that you grew up or is that somewhere that you landed?
So it's somewhere I landed. I grew up in Nanaimo.
Okay.
On the island, and I lived there until I was 18. After that, I moved down to Victoria to go to university.
Nice.
And that's where I met my wife, and we moved to Souk, not far from Victoria, to be halfway between university and the surf up in Jordan River and that area.
Yeah.
So that's why we initially moved to Souk, but we really fell in love with that area. The hiking, the diving that's available is pretty astounding. Over both of our lives separately, we came to love Tofino before we even knew each other.
Mm.
And we lived in Tofino for one summer and did the kind of standard early 20s working in the service industry, like living in a trailer with no
living
plumbing.
Living to pay off the surfboard.
Exactly, yeah, living in the bush kind of thing. And it was really fun, but we knew that wasn't sustainable or viable long term. Mm. So we went back and finished our degrees, started our careers, and were able to move up there in the past couple of years with some really great jobs, and we were able to find a place there. So we're very fortunate.
Nice.
And we're there for good.
I feel like it's a rarity, like that you didn't just continue on, you know, living off the beaches and stuff like that, but and going back to the career. Like, that's a big move, like, mm-hmm. to be able to go back to that and to finish that kind of education side of it. Like, good for you. That's a big step. And so kind of being in there for that short time period, obviously there was enough of a draw to want to go back. So had you been able to establish like a big community there, or like how did that part of it connect for you as far as wanting to go back there?
Mm-hmm. So I have sort of an on-off relationship with that part of the island. I have some family members and uncle that used to live up there and work up there back in the day. Back in the 80s, he was a logger. Mm-hmm. He was logging up there and on Mears Island. And he lost his sight in the mid-80s and was out of the industry. And so we didn't have any family up there, but my dad used to surf kayak up there in the 90s and spent a lot of time, not so much in the Tofino area, but North Island, Cape Scott, and kind of like the northwest side of the island. And my grandparents remember going to Long Beach way back in the day before there was a paved road, before there was a national park, where it used to be more of a almost like a summer village would pop up each year. There'd be drag races on the beach. apparently you can still find some engine blocks in the sand on different tides.
That's amazing.
Yeah. It's just shockingly different to what it is now and what it's been built up into. But I first fell in love with that area when I was 10 years old, 10 or 11. My dad took my brother and I up for a surf lesson, rainy day in October, did the big drive. Had our beginner surf lesson with our big boards, and at South Chesterman Beach, it was probably just a foot tall or 2 foot tall waves, but hooked instantly. With not only the beach and surfing and feeling that rush of like the push of the wave for the first time, but really just that side of the island, like so different from the East Coast.
Just raw power. And I remember that as a kid too. That was our story as well. Like, we went over there and did these little trips and stuff, and we'd stay, I think it was on Mackenzie Beach. We would go there and we just have the blast, you know, in the middle of November, and it's just freezing cold, but you've got these beautiful waves, but there's just something, I don't know, something that pulls you as far as like how powerful all of that water, all of that, you know, energy that's coming towards you. Absolutely incredible. And it's an addicting thing.
Yeah, there's a raw energy, not only to the water, but also to like the weather and the wind, and to like the animals and extension of that, the people that can survive there.
Yeah, absolutely incredible. And as you look at like the stories of people that pioneered there and did all these crazy things, it's absolutely astounding to see what it's become now. We hadn't been there for quite a few years, and we went back there this last year, and I couldn't believe, like, it was almost fancy. It was almost darn near fancy. I was like, man, this is incredible. Like, just the development that's happened there, the, you know, the accessibility to all of these beaches and stuff. It's, I don't want to say it's sad. It's cool because you get these opportunities for people to be a part of it. But there's something that you remember when it was different. And I know the generation before us probably says the same thing. They're like, why aren't we drag strip racing on the beach anymore? You know, like, we could be going back to that. But it's crazy how that all changes. And you probably, you know, more than most, seen that. Because how long have you guys lived there for?
Well, we've only been back up there full time for about 2 years now. But we have lived up there on and off. And even in the past 5 to 10 years, we've seen a really big difference. And I think you're right. It's starting to get a little bit fancy.
Yeah.
And there's some pluses to that. There's more long-term employment in the area.
Sure.
There are some benefits to tourism. We have some really great restaurants. I mean, for a town with only a few thousand people in it, to have some like world-class restaurants and art galleries and things is pretty neat.
Yeah.
All within sort of cycling and walking distance. Definitely sort of this West Coast fancy thing where people aren't in their tuxedos, but they're wearing a $800 Arc'teryx jacket, right?
Yeah. It's not the West Coast tuxedo that you're wearing today,
right?
With the Stanfields.
I thought I'd wear the official uniform for this podcast.
That's how you know when you're really from the island, you know, when everybody's walking around with one of those, you're like, you get it. So what inspired you? I'm going to shift gears only slightly because, I mean, we could talk about all of the infrastructure and beautiful things that are happening in Tofino. But I think what's more important to me and probably to listeners of the show is your impact in the wilderness world. because that's something that we both share as far as, you know, our passion for the outdoors, and you're representing it on that west side, and I really love that. I mean, you're going all over the place too, but why the wilderness? Like, why was that the pull for you? And you're such a good storyteller. Like on Instagram, I love the heading Island Storyteller. I think it was one of the things that drew me in right away. I was like, oh, I'd love to hear more. I'd love to, you know, kind of get drawn into that. So I know I tackled like six things there, mm-hmm. but what as far as the wilderness side of it, why did you pick that part of the West Coast?
Sure. Yeah. And I'll set a foundation by maybe describing sort of my introduction to the outdoors as a kid.
Sure.
So I was fortunate enough to spend a lot of time outside with my family, and most of my family members, my adult family members when I was a kid, just enjoyed doing different things, and I've carried those on. A really great example would be my dad is a huge lover of all things in the water. So we grew up as competitive swimmers and went to lifeguarding and all that coaching and everything like that. But we'd spend every single waking moment in the summer with just jumping into a river, a lake. If it wasn't the pool, we'd be jumping in the river on our way back home. The summer months were spent with your swimsuit underneath your clothes.
Totally.
Or just in your swimsuit, right? And then that extended to his introducing us to surfing and being in the ocean as we got older, which, yeah, I'm very fortunate to have had that experience in the water, because we have people who come from all over the world that want to learn how to be, whether it's surfing or diving or something, and don't have that background. So I'm very fortunate for that. Another person I have to thank for where I am now is my grandma and her love of birds and insects and all things sort of like natural and indigenous here. You know, she had 4 or 5 hummingbird feeders at her house and dozens of birds.
Oh, and, so fun.
Yeah. And as a kid, just her excitement really rubbed off on me. And she might not have known the exact... like if this was an introduced bird or native or its taxonomical designation, she just would be like, oh, that's such a handsome Steller's Jay or
just
something.
Appreciate
like,
it for
exactly.
What it was. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I really have to thank her for sort of this appreciation of what you get to see around you.
Yeah, it's absolutely spectacular. And that's something that I think that a lot of us take for granted. It's, you know, it's even just something simple as birds. I mean, it's not even simple at all. It's incredibly diverse. It has so much. You could spend all day, you know, diving right into that. But there's so much there that you can really appreciate. You can really dive right into.
Yeah. And that's what I was just so thankful for, is spending so much time outside. And it wasn't anything really formal either. We didn't sit down, you know, New Year's and have a list of all the things we wanted to do. We just spent a lot of time outside.
Nice.
And as I became like a teenager, there, of course, you just start to do teenage things. And I realized at some point I just had become really into video games. Like, that was all I did. I loved to play.
Who wasn't?
But, you know, I'd be after school, like straight onto the video game console. And I really liked a lot of the fantasy games and things like that. And when I was probably 17 or 18, I had my driver's license and I was playing a game. And I think I was walking over a mountain pass. And it was in the game, I was playing the version where, like, you know, you walked everywhere, you didn't fast travel or something like that. And I was just walking, it just like shocked me. I was like, I could just go out and do this, right? Like, I'm playing the video game on, you know, hiking through the mountains, and I'm closing the blinds so I can see it better because it's such a beautiful day out.
Like,
I could be outside doing any of this, spending just as much time, but actually like involving myself in the natural world. So I went to my dad and then I was like, Dad, where should I go for a hike? He's like, Elk River Trail, Strathcona Park. He's like, I did that when I was in grade 7. You should go do that.
Amazing.
And I was
place.
Like, okay, I will. So I grabbed my dad's old leather like boots, like hand-me-down boots. I think I had an army surplus backpack. I had a toque from the Winter Olympics, some like cotton toque, right? A big knife or something, because I knew I'd have to have that to protect myself from bears. And yeah, up I went, and I did that hike as a day hike from the car up to Berg Lake and back. And just beautiful, fantastic, amazing trail.
Awe-inspiring.
Yeah. I was blown away.
Yeah.
Blown away. And yeah, that was really my first my first introduction of where I put myself into the wilderness. And I was just in that position of just feeling like so connected and so revitalized by the outdoors.
Elk River Trail is one of those places that a lot of people have had that same experience. And it's super cool to hear it because, and to hear it from you, because it is one of those things that, you know, it's a big, long trail. It's not a crazy elevation gain. You know, it's really quite accessible. But the payoff at the end on a clear day is you cannot be anything but stunned, you know, sitting at the foot of Colonel Foster and seeing this massive side of the mountain that carved out this lake. Like, it just makes you feel so small and so appreciate the accomplishment that you've just done. Your dad's a wise man. He sent you to the right place.
Yeah. And after that, I was hooked. So the next thing I did was I started to look onto the websites that were available at the time. And a lot of them were those old school 90s HTML, like sort of one of the unfortunate things back then.
Some of them are still
the same. The same, yeah. These people that spend so much time in the outdoors don't spend a lot of time learning how to code.
That's right. Yes, right? Totally. That technical side is usually a little bit lacking, unfortunately. Not always.
Nope.
But you know, there are those that would be like, hey, I'm not that bad. But there are some of you, yeah, we love you, but you're not great at it.
So really my introduction to the outdoors and the world around me was through a Backroads map book. I think I got it from either a gas station or a grocery store.
Gold.
Yeah. And just poring over that. I had it in school. I had it in the car. I had any time I was driving around, I'd try and find trails and parks and anything that I could just go see. Because after being in Strathcona, I just became addicted to this. It's a drug for me where it's like just what's around the next corner.
Totally.
What's over the up the next draw, over that mountain pass, just that one last little bit we'll see. And then you do it and you're like, oh, well, that tree looks really cool over there. What's behind that? Right?
You're such a kindred spirit. You're making me so happy that you're here. But it's true. You go, it doesn't matter where you go. You can be walking in the middle of the bush and you're not even getting a view. And you just want to see what those next group of trees is going to look like. And I think that there's something really special about that. Anyway, keep going.
Yeah, that's it. And just I had a pencil with me and started checking off trails, checking off parks. And over, it became the thing I really loved to do. And when I moved down to Victoria, I was able to get introduced to some of those amazing trail systems there. The CRD has some really great ones, and there's some good provincial parks throughout there too. But it became difficult, moving down there for university, and there's the typical university life and what kids like to do and the party scene. And I participated in that to an extent, I think like anybody in university does, but other times too, people would be getting ready for the party and I'd be putting on my boots and backpack and being like, okay, see you guys
ready for the morning
on Monday or whatever. And eventually I had some people asking to come out and join me, and I was by no means an expert, but I was very excited to have people along. Eventually I just started sharing things on Instagram. That was really a forum for me. And it was back in the day when Instagram looked a lot different than it does now.
Sure.
A lot less formal, not very many people, if any, were making money or a living off of it. So, but it was a really great way to keep a digital journal. And I started a little hashtag just to kind of share my own adventures and romps through the woods, which was West Makes You Wilder, which is just a feeling I got kind of after that initial trip. But anytime I felt stressed from school or work or family life, I just felt like this pull to the West Coast, to the West, and just like it made me feel wilder and more connected to a true like human experience.
Oh, it's fantastic. So then for the places that you got to explore down there, do you like West Coast Trail, Juan de Fuca Trail, like those those spots too? Like you got to go do those?
Yeah. So the West Coast, I haven't done the West Coast Trail. It's a bucket list.
I just haven't
got a booking yet. Yeah. And it hasn't worked out with some other things we like to do when the trail's open for the year. And but the Juan de Fuca Trail, for sure. We've spent a lot of time there hiking the Juan de Fuca Trail in portions. During the first year of the pandemic, I had the opportunity to actually go and hike the entirety of the trail. I went and did it by myself, which was a fantastic learning experience and what I like to call type 2 fun.
Oh,
it rained the entire time.
It's the good stuff.
Yeah. I had standing water in my tent. And yeah, I learned a lot of lessons and I look back on it fondly.
But the moments that you're like, this is horrible, this is terrible, how could this ever be beneficial? And then, you know, you're here and you're like, mm-hmm. no, actually it is. It is something really important. And those are the things that stand out. I found, and you're going to find this too, as you step further and further into fatherhood, that it's really, really fascinating being on the other side now, watching your kids go through what you're describing type two. And we've talked about on the show, but just to kind of recap on it, type one's kind of that instant gratification, super simple, you know, playing a video game, for example, or just going out and doing something really, really, you know, basic, and it's really fun and you feel happy and you're like, that was great. The other things are, you know, type two is going to be probably pretty hard at the moment. Maybe you're even going to hate that moment, but at that, you know, opportunity to look back on it, it's really quite fascinating. You're like, no, that was amazing. And this is what I learned from it. This is what I took from that opportunity. And it's really fascinating now watching my kids do that and not step in there and be like, I really want to make this super fun for you right now. Mm-hmm. But it can't be, because they have to experience that. Otherwise, their story is just going to be, you know, very one-dimensional, where it could be way more. So that's really, really cool. And I think that you're doing that really, really well. This is a bit of a bunny trail, but even just seeing what you're headed towards for Elliot is awesome. Like, just the stuff that you're doing. So, you know, bringing them out on the West Coast, bringing them out to these trails, you're already immersing in the wilderness, which is really, really, you know, really quite fascinating to see.
So. Yeah, before Elliot was born, actually probably the couple years leading up to when we were pregnant, on the weekends, my wife and I started to have a conversation Sunday night. We're like, is there anything we did this weekend that wouldn't be better with kids, right? Or like that we couldn't do? And there was very rarely a case where we were like canyoneering or mountain climbing or something where you couldn't do it with a baby, right? Oftentimes we were either hiking or foraging or spending time at the beach. And that's really our lifestyle, is we spend a lot of time in the water, time at the beach, and time gathering food.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's really, though those are like more accessible ways to introduce kids into that world. And even to have an infant on your back, doesn't take much to, you know, take them out berry picking or something like that.
Yeah. It's a tangible thing, right? And as they grow, it'll just be a very, very normal thing. So what inspired that side of it? Because I mean, there's one thing to experience the West Coast. There's one thing to experience the Elk River Trail and go and hike. But then I feel like you've taken it a whole step further, where now, you know, you're looking at the things that are edible from the wilderness. You're looking at how you can live sustainably off the land. Like, that's something that both of us share, that we value. What brought you to that point where you wanted to, you know, be more of an advocate and more of a storyteller in that zone?
Yeah, I think it was just that I was becoming increasingly uncomfortable with how my food was delivered to me.
Sure.
And this stemmed from, a general feeling when I was in university, and I was in a political science and then geography and coastal studies. And so learning a lot about this local area and the species here and the ecology and the biodiversity and the challenges that a lot of those systems are facing, existential crises in some cases. Mm-hmm. And I would be, you know, driving on my way to campus and I'd go and stop for a sandwich or a burger, and my only connection to my food was tapping a piece of plastic, right? And then someone, an anonymous person, handed me a bag out a window. Mm-hmm. And that was my connection to meat and to my relationship with animal protein. And I got, increasingly uncomfortable with that. So what I started doing when I was in Victoria during my university years is spearfishing and free diving.
Which is no joke.
No, it's not.
No joke. So for people that don't know what it is, give us a little bit of a picture of what you're talking about when you're saying free diving.
Sure, yeah. So as sort of a distinction from scuba diving, so with free diving, you don't have any oxygen tank, breathing apparatus, buoyancy suit, dry suit, nothing like that. You'd be in what most people would recognize as a wetsuit. Sometimes they're made of a more like an open cell neoprene, which is just warmer. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes there's a camo pattern to help disguise you from fish. I have one that's like that. I don't know if it helps me at all, but it sure looks cool for pictures
totally
and things. Yeah, and then you'd have a spear, either like a spear with an elastic band on one end and a pointy end on the other that you hold in your hand, and or a spear gun, which launches a spear either on a line that's on the base of the gun. And there's a lot of opportunity particularly around Southern Vancouver Island, but on the inshore of the island just as much as the outside, for rock cod, ling cod, sole, yeah, all sorts. And in the more unconventional foods that I think a lot of people haven't been exposed to, not to say that they haven't been eaten by people for generations, right? But sea urchin, sea cucumber,
yeah,
all that sort of thing.
Yeah, these delicacies that are a little bit more unknown to those that don't partake in that kind of a, you know, a sport, because it's quite involved anyway, yeah.
So that's what I started with. I started with spearfishing, and I just felt it was a way, as a college kid, to be able to do it. Like, I couldn't afford a boat. I couldn't afford a salmon boat. And, you know, it allows you to get down there and select carefully, to harvest carefully, puts you in the food chain a little bit. You're down there underwater with everything else.
And there's nothing else you can focus on but that moment.
That's right. Yeah. And so you have to hold your breath and dive down and see what you can get. And so that became a really big passion of mine for many years. It's something I don't do as much of now as a young dad, just because it's hard to do, impossible to do with a baby.
And it's probably one of those things, I imagine, like I've never done it, but I imagine that it's something that you kind of have to keep up on,
because you do.
You got to have your lungs trained. You got to have, you know, your technique pretty well dialed, I imagine, because there's a lot of factors into that kind of fishing that aren't necessarily like, let's pick up a rod and throw it in the river. You know, there's a lot more that goes into that.
And fortunately, there's a lot of people on the island that are passionate about teaching that. So there are quite a few schools. No matter kind of where you are, you can probably find a freediving school around you where you can get certified. And of all the questions I've ever fielded online about spearfishing, that's the one I always go back to.
Get educated.
Yeah, spend the money on a course.
Yeah.
And there's some people, Chris Adair of Bottom Dwellers Freediving, not sponsored to tell you about him at all, just a very good guy. He even offers just a course on selective harvesting, which is really cool.
Nice.
And so you get to know, I mean, there's the regulations and the fish that the government say that you can take and how many, but if that's really ethical or not, like there's some more harvesting ethics to it than just what the regulations allow.
Yeah. Right?
So yeah, there's awesome courses. There's never been a better time to get involved in that if you're interested.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I cannot stress to anybody, like, that is something you really want to know before you go, because it's not one of those things you can just dive into. You know, don't look at it like normal fishing. No, that's awesome. So then now we're kind of getting into a bit of another area where I wanted to go, was you're a part of the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers Association.
Right.
So what's your role with them?
So I'm a table member here on Vancouver Island. Backcountry Hunters and Anglers is relatively new to Canada. It's been established more formally in the United States, but the BC chapter and our region one, which is Vancouver Island, if any of the listeners are familiar with how the hunting regions are set up in BC, we've sort of just like set up our regions the same way.
Nice.
So region one, Vancouver
Island. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Yeah.
And then 9.
Okay. So I'm a table member on Vancouver Island, and I represent the west coast of the island. And yeah, the angling side, there's a portion of that, but the hunting side too is something that I've really only come to experience as an adult. It's not something I grew up doing at all. Even in my early 20s, I wasn't even sure how I felt about it. But when I was in university studying this area and the ecology and the people, something I came across time and time again was just like the care and commitment that these hunting organizations or even hunting writers had, right? So you'd run into writers like Aldo Leopold and people like that, or, you know, you look at the Nanaimo Fish and Game Club is established in 1902 or whatever, right? Like just legacy groups and people that have really, really cared. Yeah. Roderick Haig Brown from around here too, right? In a different way on the rivers. And
but specifically with the idea of how do we do this in a way that's sustainable? How do we do this that we're conserving what we have, because we're, you know, the reality is we're a part of this ecosystem wherever we're living. And so there's an impact both ways. And so how do we manage that in a way that works better? So that's really fantastic. Do they have more of an emphasis of like more the deep country than for the backcountry hunters?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the line is a little blurry, but they usually say either 2 miles, 5 kilometers off the road.
Nice.
You know, there's all these like pithy sayings, like the fun starts where the road ends kind of stuff, right? And yeah, getting out into the backcountry and being able to recreate on public land and advocating for access to public land, but mostly to make sure that the habitat stays secure and intact. And ensure like these hunting opportunities that people have enjoyed here since time immemorial.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's really neat too, like you were talking about that relationship with meat, and that's something that we've talked about here on the show as well too, because that was something that it was the same thing for us. We got to a point where I was like, I'm not comfortable with it either. And so I want to have either, you know, more of a connection, or this may just not be a part of our lives. And so when we started doing that, that was something that we were really conscious about, because we want to pass that on to another generation because there's value there. And what's really neat is that when you hear about organizations like Backcountry Hunters and Anglers and all these other ones that are out, the BC Wildlife Federation, all these other spots, it's incredible how much these people care, you know, and how much is out there as far as their advocacy for the wildlife. Like, it's a hard thing to explain to those that aren't a part of it, but I have rarely ever seen a group of people that care more about the wildlife than those that hunt it, which is a bit of a weird, a bit of a weird perspective, but I really believe in it. And I think that it's something that that, you know, people need to know more about. And so it sounds like that's something that, you know, is a value for your guys as well.
Yeah, and it's something I've run into. You just nailed it there. It's a contention. It's this tension in the air of like the people that, you know, go out and kill, harvest, and animals seem to care the most. And it's true. And so I've been really fortunate to have some mentors through BHA and through other hunting communities. With Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, I got to say I'm probably the least qualified and experienced member. There's some people who have just spent their entire lives in the bush and are so dedicated to it. But I've been able to be fortunate to kind of tag along with them and learn what I can, and more importantly, sort of join in on their conservation efforts here on the island. One of our most recent ones was a big cleanup of Little Mountain.
So cool. And that was in Nanaimo, or is it?
Just outside of Parksville.
Parksville.
Yeah,
okay,
Little
okay.
Mountain.
Yeah, tell
there.
Us about that. That looked awesome.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's been a project. Almost decades in the work now. There's been some efforts to clean up what had become an informal garbage dump for the community. You can drive right up to the top of Little Mountain. Back in the day, you could drive right up to the edge of the cliff. It's a beautiful place to go watch the sunset and take a look at Aerosmith and Coakley and Moriarty. But unfortunately, people would just like dump their truckloads of garbage off there, and over years the base of the cliff accumulated like feet of accumulated garbage. So yeah, it's been a multi-pronged cleanup effort. BHA has been a partner. Rotary Club of Parksville has been a partner. And just gathering the garbage and what could be removed took many years itself. And then there was lifts of, I think we did like 50 helicopter lifts out of there.
Wow, that's a big work. That's a big deal.
And so tons and tons, like literal tons and tons of garbage, ranging from tires and household, you know, trash to washing machines. Yeah.
It's absolutely fascinating the liberties people will take, even when, it, you know, it could have been as simple as like years ago, somebody thought, oh, actually, I don't really have anywhere to put this mattress. I'm going to throw it off this, you know, the edge of this cliff. And then somebody else goes, hey, that's a good idea. And how that, you know, my kids do that all the time. They're like, yeah, no, but he went down to the river. You said it, we couldn't. But yeah, but our 4-year-old brother, he went down there, so we should be able to too. It's something about being human that we're like, but someone else did it.
Yeah, that gives you the social license to get away with it. Right. It blows my mind.
And all of a sudden you're like a generation's wealth of garbage, in one spot. Well done. So were you able to tackle like most of that?
Most of it.
Mm-hmm. Amazing.
Yeah.
Absolutely amazing.
And so I'm really excited to go back 6 months, a year, 5 years later and really see how parts of that area has been reclaimed by wildlife. There is some old growth in there, some beautiful groves of Douglas fir.
Mm.
Yeah. And now, you know, that base of the hill has always been used by my many different groups. You know, there's been hikers, mountain bikers, everybody through there. Hopefully now there's more area and better habitat for people to enjoy.
Amazing. No, that's fantastic. I love that. So I'm going to switch gears just a little bit back to kind of the West Coast side of things. Kind of we're headed up. We're actually even getting close to the end. Isn't that crazy? Time just flies.
Crazy, yeah.
But as far as experiencing the West Coast and for, because you have that experience, because you've been there, what's things that you would pass on to other people as far as helping steward that? Because there are more people going to Tofino. There are more people that are heading up to the Pacific Rim, want to experience it, want to be there. It's becoming more and more, not even just nationally recognized, but internationally recognized as a place to go. For you, like, what's something that you would pass on to other people to help steward that, you know?
Yeah, you're right. The traffic is increasing every year, and the human imprint does leave an impact. Mm-hmm. I remember having profs in university that were writing papers back in the 90s about the impact on whale watching tours on gray whales and where they feed. Interestingly enough, I think it's completely anecdotal, but in the first year of the pandemic when nobody was coming up here to take whale watching tours, well, what did we see right against the beaches, North Chesterman and South Chesterman and Cox?
Yeah.
Was mother and calf whales just rolling around in the waves feeding because there wasn't the same level of boat traffic. But as beautiful as it is, and I really do love sharing that area with people and seeing their reaction to how, just like the raw energy like we talked about. The tourism isn't completely impact free, right? So there are ways to make your stay a little bit easier on the land. One of which is just to kind of stay in those places that are well trodden.
Nice. Yeah, absolutely.
As much as I advocate for being out in the backcountry and in the bush, parts of that area, I mean, it's a UNESCO biosphere reserve and they're very sensitive. It's like unlike other places on earth. So staying on like, you know, marked trails and beaches and as hard as it can be to follow the rules, it might feel like a little bit of a wet blanket sometimes. Just to, you know, you don't
stay on the boardwalk.
Stay on the boardwalk, keep the fireworks at home.
Yeah.
Maybe your dog on leash when the shorebirds are around, that sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. It is very beautiful though, no matter what you like to do up there, whether it's just sitting in a lawn chair and watching the waves and the surfers all day, whether it's getting in the water or getting out on the ocean, there's so much to see.
Yeah. And they've done a good job of making that very accessible for anybody that hasn't been to that area and gone through there, which is actually really quite fascinating. I've talked to people who lived here their whole life and they're like, yeah, I've never been to
Tofino. We have friends, no family, but friends for sure from Victoria who've never been up to Tofino.
It's mind-boggling.
I'm not sure if they think the drive is daunting or not, but yeah.
I mean, right now with all the construction, probably.
Yeah.
It is a little bit daunting, but still, like what beforehand, it was absolutely, like, oh man, I just don't know how you couldn't experience it there. Mm-hmm. Absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
No, that's absolutely great. And it was just thinking, they just put, it was kind of going through that accessibility thing. I think Cathedral Grove, I think, just put in boardwalk all the way through their stuff.
Right, yeah.
And my first feeling, and it really surprised me, was no, I want to feel the ground. I want to be there by the trees. But because it's one of these places that's, you know, right there on the side of the road that is so incredibly accessible and so well known, it has to. And I think Pacific Rim and the rest of those places, you know, even the Pacific Wild Pacific Trail through Iqaluit, like, are beautiful. Absolutely beautiful how they've made it so it's accessible and you can be there and it's just as easy, you know, stay on the path. But for my kids who are used to being able to run around in the bush, you know, they're like, no, let's go over there. Like, no, because if everybody did that, we just open up everything, right? No, that's fantastic. Where can people follow you on online and follow your stories?
That would be Van Island on Instagram. That's where
lines.
Yeah, the underscore on each side.
Yeah. I know my words.
Yeah, that's where you can find most of my content. And I did spend a lot of time taking pictures of the island and attaching a story to them. I think my passion deep down is just sharing stories with others, whether that's through photography or video or the written word. As I was able to explore and learn more about this place myself, what really connected me to it was not only just like seeing, I don't know, a waterfall or a valley, but like the history behind it or what's unique about it. And there's so much to dig into. So that's something I really try and put a twist on is each post I do, I try and add some twist to it where there's a deeper level. I like to talk about buried epistemologies. things that epistemology is being like things we think are true, like buried ones are the ones that we think are true, but we don't think about. Mm-hmm. It's the things you don't know that you think are true.
Absolutely.
And I really like challenging those preconceptions about the land here, how it's been used, how it came to be, and where it's going to go from here.
Yeah. And I think what's really, really valuable to anybody, we were talking about this before we started recording a bit, but just creating resources and accessibility for those people who may not, you know, even the simplest of things, like we were talking about, you know, taking a dump in the woods, like sometimes that's a thing if you're in the middle of the backcountry and not necessarily like something that people are going to think through. And you do a really good job of stewarding that through your stories. Like I find I learn something all the time, and others will too. And the neat thing too, the way you've structured it is that you can go back into the stuff that you've done, whether it's recent or not. A lot of it's pretty timeless, and your discussions and how you look at, you know, wildlife, how you look at the natural world around us and how we experience it. I think you've done a fabulous job, Caleb, of being able to represent that and continue to be a storyteller that is an advocate not only just for that experience, but for the wilderness itself. Really well done.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. Yeah. And yeah, when it comes to harvesting any of the food here on the island, I'd like to encourage any of the listeners too that it doesn't have to be, you know, getting your license to go hunting and waiting for an elk tag or something like that. There's so much you can do from even just harvesting some of the invasive species we have here, like Himalayan blackberry. But in the spring, you can get into things like stinging nettle. Maple leaf blossoms are out here for about a week or two. It's a very short, very short harvesting season, but there's so much to enjoy, and you can fill your freezer and you can put together some meals from some foods that you might not even think about. Like we have invasive bullfrogs here on the island, and you can go out and have a really great time harvesting those and cook up and fry up the legs. It's a great thing to do with the family. You can make berry pies and salmon berry pies and things like that. It doesn't have to be this like complete commitment to being on a backpack hunt or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
And it's the same thing for engaging into the wilderness or just getting into the mountains and on the trails. It can be so intimidating for people when they first start out. And some groups, like I'll be honest, some groups do a little bit of gatekeeping, right? They'll make fun of people that are just starting out. Or they're like, you know, I went on a wilderness trail and I hiked up to the Goldstream Trestle.
Yeah.
Right? And people will be like, oh, the Goldstream, that's not. But for some people, that's a really big deal.
Totally.
Yeah. Or climbing Mount Finlayson or going a little mountain, right? It's beautiful.
It's extremely subjective to the individual and it should be.
Yeah. And so I do try and remove a lot of the barriers because we joked about like taking a poop in the woods. For some people, that really is a barrier, or it might stack on other things that just keeps them out of the woods. So it might be that they don't know how to poop in the woods. They don't know what to put in their backpack. They don't know what to pack for lunch. They're not sure what sort of socks to wear.
Yeah.
And all of those things seem silly, right? If you just dealt with each one, but once there's five or six of those things, it can be debilitating.
Absolutely.
So really trying to remove those barriers and to provide that information in a fun and lighthearted way.
That's fantastic. I really appreciate that. And I think that others will too. Really appreciate you taking the time and being on this side of the island. And I'm really looking forward to seeing where your journey goes as you continue into the role of not only just being an advocate for wilderness, but being a dad, being able to pass that on to another generation. There's something really quite profound and fabulous about that. And I think that you're on the right track. So thanks so much for coming down to the show, Caleb. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for listening to this week's Wild Islander podcast with Caleb Harding. If you want to follow along with his journey, you can check him out on Instagram and also leave us a review. Tell us what you think of the show. You can do that on any of the platforms that we are currently hosting on. And we would love to hear back from you. And if you have people that you want to hear from on Vancouver Island, shoot us a message at thewildislanderpodcast@gmail.com. Not many of us actually are very good at planning ahead, but if you happen to be that person who is thinking long term, like Father's Day coming up in about a month, and you're thinking, what am I going to get? What is that special
father figure in my life need? Well, if they happen to be somebody who's an outdoors person and really love the hunting world, you can go check out vanislehunter.ca, where you can check out their hats, shirts, and decals. I've been wearing their hats for years. Absolutely hold up in just about any venue that you can think of here on the island. And they are available here, designed right here on Vancouver Island. Check them out at vanislehunter.ca to go check out and find that perfect thing for that perfect huntsperson in your life.